Hello, everybody. This is the Gingerbread Man, and I would like to welcome you to my home. Thanks for being here. Come on in. I just woke up, so not really quite sure where we're going to be going yet, but I do know that I had a confounding amount of dreams last night. Like, so many. Or maybe it was just in the last 20 minutes before I woke up. But I have been actively trying to think myself into a dream for several years now. When I was younger, I didn't dream much, and I'm not sure why, or maybe I was, but I wasn't remembering it, or there's all kinds of different ways to analyze that situation. I have like a whole bunch of my own pet theories. I think dreaming also has something to do with how creative a person is, and somebody's imagination and artistic talent can also be tied to how they dream, at least in my opinion, not empirically based. So, some of the dreams that step out to me that I can remember are the ones that send more fear into me and that have more physical reactions. Several weeks back, I was sleeping, and while I was in my dream, I was looking for my son, like, voraciously. And I remember just this intense feeling of being rushed, and I was, like, on the outside of the school, like, looking into all the classrooms, but there was, like, nobody there, and it was empty. And also, the school itself was not the school that he goes to. And this was all very clear to me, but I can't tell you why. And when I woke up, I was just terribly afraid, like terribly afraid. And I immediately realized that it was a dream, that my son was sleeping next to me, and that everything was okay. But still, it scared the shit out of me. And how I rationalized that one was, I chose to say that this was my subconscious showing me how important my son was. And through this psychic reaction, I could see how bad I'd feel if I actually lost him. And that's probably like one of the worst things that I could possibly imagine happening to me, is losing my son. And of course, there's a lot of other baggage attached to what happens to the missing child. But I just, even thinking about it now, makes my stomach tight and my heart clench. Like, it's been so rare that I haven't known where my son is, you know, and that's what this dream taught me. Around that time period, I also had another dream where I was walking around a crowded party, and this one, there was a lot of other people in it with me, but I don't remember clearly who everybody was during most of it. There was different scenes, and some of the scenes I might have been more clear, but it's so hard for me to dig into the space of my mind. But I'm walking around, and everybody has hot pink hair. And it's like, it started out like slow at first, like some people had hot pink hair. And then by the end of the dream, like over a time frame, I'm walking around and everybody has hot pink hair. And I had no idea what the fuck was going on until I woke up the next day and I looked down at my shoes. And at that time period, I had happened to have pink shoelaces, and it was almost the exact same color as the hair color of everybody. And I'm not sure what I was trying to tell myself there either, but it was still kind of funny. So, yeah. I don't often dream about people or places in particular, and I don't often dream about natural environments, which makes me sad, because if I were in some sort of fantasy world, I feel like I would imagine something far more compelling with castles and dragons, and I always seem to be in like very humble, boring buildings or like around like industrial schools or in like my home or at my place of business, but I'm never like outside of my regular routine in my waking world. Whereas there's this concept of people called lucid dreamers who seem to have an immense control over what they can do. Are you a lucid dreamer? These are the kind of things that I find highly compelling, is when people can control these things. Like, for me, most of my dream history is black, and now that I'm getting glimpses, it's definitely not controllable. And often how I remember my dreams is when I'm awake. It's not even when I'm waking up. Like, as I'm living my life, I'll have strange memories, and because my dreams are so boring, they'll clink with the memories of reality, and I'll go, oh, that didn't happen, that was a dream. And I've been able to find a back door into remembering dreams that way. But these lucid dreamers, you know, I've known many, and It's funny when you talk to somebody because they look at you like it's not normal that you can't. You know, it's such a natural skill. It's inherent for somebody to be able to do this. But even with inherent talents, I do think people can think and practice themselves into it. There's always the moldability and the plastic nature of who we are. So I've heard many different crazy stories about lucid dreamers and like the ability to fly at will. And some lucid dreamers talk about having to have a disattachment to will and letting things happen. And so they might be observing it as well. And when they try to control their flight, they fall. So some people have a degree of control, it seems, on some sort of scale of impact. But it's very cool. And I wish I could do it, you know, like lucid dreaming to me sounds like the perfect hallucinogen. If you can control the visuals and you have only your internal world, like that's amazing. I heard this one story that I'm going to repeat, and it was about this guy who was a very good lucid dreamer. And he had this one dream where he is walking around a footpath around this beautiful picturesque pond, you know, and then there's like ducks and geese and like all kinds of like water plants, and it's a beautiful blue day, and there's like park benches around this pond, and he's just walking in a circle, and there's all kinds of other characters and peoples walking around it. And at first he didn't realize that it was a dream, but as he's walking around this circle, sitting at a bench is a real world Beavis from Beavis and Butthead, like with the crazy, like crazy shaped head, and like, and but in the real world form, like not cartoon. And so this thing immediately stepped out to him, and that's what gathered his attention that he was dreaming. And he goes, wow, oh, that's ridiculous. And so he's talking about how he's often looking for these ridiculous aspects of the conscious that help reveal when we're dreaming, which I also find compelling. One of the friends that was talking to this fellow as they were describing the situation, I think I heard it on some podcast, you know, he goes, well, if an alien or a god was to step into your subconscious, do you think it's going to appear as something that you cannot recognize, or is it going to appear to you as something incredibly ridiculous, like a real-world Beavis? And I also found that very interesting. But yet, I don't get dreams like that yet. I'm still thinking myself into them and practicing. So one of the really good techniques that I heard for practicing lucidity, or at least noticing when we are in our sleep, is the doorframe test. So as you go throughout your day, every time you enter and exit a room, you go through a doorframe. And what you're supposed to do is put your hand onto the doorframe and seriously think, you know, like, is this a real doorframe? Am I in the real world or not? The idea is that one day you'll find yourself walking around in a dream. And once you are there, you'll touch a doorframe and you go, hey, this isn't real. But you do it thousands and thousands and thousands of time. And this picker that discriminates and distinguishes whether or not we are in a waking consciousness or not is still applicable in both stances. So this discriminator of the conscious exists even when we are unconscious, and we can still subjectively glimpse, see, and discriminate while we are not conscious. That's very interesting. So I have a lot of theories about how psychedelic substances affects subjective ability to sense data as well. I just told this story recently. So when I was younger, several years back, one of my favorite things to do was to introduce people to dimethyltryptamine, which is, as a lot of you guys know, the classical psychedelic smokable inhalant that has the tendency to be quite visionary, but it is very short-lived, very, very short-lived, like practically 5 to 10 minutes, and most of the substance is gone or done. But an afterglow can exist for a while, because I do think that there is a cathartic or a catalytic reaction, like dominoes hitting dominoes, that happens within our mental scape when we put these things in. But when I first found it, I was very intrigued by it, and I had a very easy access to it, which I'm not going to go into any further. And this was several years ago, and I have no, like, none of this applies to the modern day or now or the present in any way, shape, or form. And none of this is recommendational, and this is not what I do anymore. But in my youth, you know, like, I was probably in my first or my second semester of college. I was quite young, and I couldn't even drive, so I would find somebody with wheels to come pick me up, and then I would literally go through my phone and my social media and talk to any and everybody, even people who weren't close friends, to find if they'd had any interaction with this substance. And I called it the professor, you know. And anybody who had any interest in trying DMT, I would go over and immediately help facilitate the process. I kind of got a ritual down where, you know, I like to be in other people's homes, and I think people were most comfortable in their own bedroom or their own living space, not surrounded by people. And yet again, this, none of this is recommendational. These are just pure subjective opinions from what I've seen. And so I would help facilitate, and then I would leave and leave them completely alone to their own processes and their own mental machinations, after which I would return to check on them approximately 7 to 10 minutes later with a cup of water, and usually they were very happy and gleeful to tell me bits and pieces of what they'd experienced at this point. But I had found many, many people, and I've been doing this for several months, almost on a daily process. And so I arrived at a friend's house that we'll call Smiley, like the lighter. And I get there, and within a very short amount of time of being there, I lit up and wanted to smoke a little bit to show him that I was comfortable doing it, and was completely blown away by the strength of the substance. And so, people, I had never, ever been in this man's backyard before, ever. So I had no idea or memory or any sort of preconceived notion of what his backyard was. Most people don't want to move around or walk, but I happen to pop up a lot like a jack-in-the-box depending upon my energy level, and I have wandered, which is sometimes dangerous, and I think this has something to do with my sleepwalking potential. And what's also interesting about that is a lot of sleepwalkers, I wonder how much they dream or do not, and that'd be other interesting information. So I walk into this dude's backyard right after smoking this psychedelic substrate, and I arrive into a white field that's pretty much like that scene from The Matrix when Neo sits down with Morpheus at the couch with the TV and there's nothing but white around them. I had nothing to put into my visual, and because I had nothing to even work with, my brain presented it as white first, as pretty much nothing. And over time, it started to break into kaleidoscopic action, and I wanted to fuck out of it because I wanted to get back in the house because it was quite scary. But what this showed me is that there is a breach between the visual input of what we can see and the subjective crunching of perception. There is a big separation between gathering data and seeing it. And oftentimes, I think we just amalgamate it because the brain is so good at processing that when our consciousness gets a hold of the object from the outside, we like to look at it as a finished picture and we trust it. But that finished object of perception, even in waking consciousness, is still being discriminated upon. And I wonder how much impact that discriminator of consciousness, of reality, of what is, has to do with how we feel about what is. And I know this is getting very, very confusing, so I hope that you can please follow along a little longer. Wouldn't this give us immense control if we can learn to work with our discriminator? And rather than go into psychosis and see everything as illusionary, which it very well might be, couldn't we become co-creators in our illusions? Could we not make our waking world lucid and have lucidity over our actions and our feelings because of how we discriminate it? Could the actions of being lucid in a dream have more to do with waking reality than we ever knew? These are just some questions that I'm wondering about. Either way, I don't have enough information. And I feel the best way to get to the bottom of this is to have a conversation about it. So if you have any sort of really cool dream stories, any sort of lucidity stories, especially if you're a lucid dreamer, or even if you have nightmares, or if you're a sleepwalker, if you want to tell any of your stories, you could email me at thegingerbreadmansdialogues@gmail.com, which I'll have easily available in the show notes. And if we have something very interesting, we can have a discourse, so we could talk about it. But I'll put your story on the show towards the beginning, probably. I'll do a listener end sort of input, and we could start getting to the bottom of the group's fucking subjective opinion of what dreaming is. Because I'm very interested in your experience, and I'm very curious. I want you to know that. So please reach out to me. Before we get on to quotes, I want to have a little segment about frustration and calm and reaction. One of the psychological principles I remember learning in like social work and a lot of my other psych classes and when I was doing social sciences in college is the fact that a calm demeanor and being able to be confident, which confidence and calm are linked together. We can't be confident when we are frantic. And franticity comes from fear and from that flight or flight response, fight or flight response that we have internally. So a lot of people, especially men, I've found, we lean into our frustration because we want to punch out our obstacles and we want to be able to beat down the things that have become difficult for us. But I have this belief that once, as soon as we become frustrated, you know, very, very quickly after, our mental capacity to think outside the box starts to go down. The center of self that I think is inside of us, that some might call soul, spirit, and some might even want to call their identity. I'm not even going to argue an identity-ish crisis here. You know, wherever that center is that I lean into when I'm trying to help and when I'm looking for information, when I'm trying to solve a problem, a lot of the times it takes going into a state of calm and taking a couple deep breaths and activating my parasympathetic response where I can then look inwards and ask for help and ask for some sort of information. And then from inside comes my answer. But when I'm frustrated, I am forefront to right at the top of the ship and I'm frantically turning the wheels left and right and hitting things the whole way, you know? And by brute force trying to manhandle or womanhandle my situation into something that's more palatable. But I wonder how often I have been actually successful in physically making my outer external world fit my internal whims. I'm not too sure about that. So calm is a much better place to be than frustrated, especially when we are in a difficult situation where we need to critically think and problem solve, and when we need especially some sort of ulterior approach. So keep that in mind this week, and maybe just keep an inner eye on that speedometer and see how frantic or calm you are. I'm going to be doing the same. All right, I'm going to go grab a good book. All right, guys. This week, I have for you a little section from D.T. Suzuki's composite on Zen Buddhism. This is a really brief overview and like explanation of background, where, how, there's a lot of history in it, but there's also a lot of really good excerpts from sutras and different sayings from old Buddhists that I found compelling. So here goes. To make the position of the sixth patriarch on the subject of meditation still clearer and more definite, let me quote another incident from his Platform Sutra. A monk once made a reference to a gatha composed by Wu Lan, which read as follows. I, Wu Lan, know a device whereby to blot out all my thoughts. The objective would no more stir the mind, and daily matures my enlightenment. Hearing this, the sixth patriarch, Hunyang, remarked, that is no enlightenment, but leads one into a state of bondage. Listen to my gatha. I, Hunyang, know no device. My thoughts are not suppressed. The objective world ever stirs the mind. And what is the use of maturing enlightenment? These will be sufficient to show that Hunyang, the sixth patriarch, was on one hand no quietist, nor nihilist, advocating the doctrine of absolute emptiness, while on the other hand, he was no idealist either, in the sense of denying any objective world. His jhana was full of action, yet above a world of particulars, so long as it was not carried away by it and in it. Huineng's method of demonstrating the truth of Zen was purely Chinese and not Indian. He did not resort to abstract terminology nor to romantic mysticism. The method was direct, plain, concrete, and highly practical. When the monk Ming came to him and asked for instruction, he said, show me your original face before you were born. It is not the statement quite to the point. No philosophic discourse, no elaborate reasoning, no mystic imagery, but a direct, unequivocal dictum. In this, the sixth patriarch cut the first turf, and his disciples quickly and efficiently followed his steps. All right. So there's a lot of different types of meditations, and there's active meditations and passive meditations. And what I spent a lot of my time doing towards the beginning of the show, you can listen back and hear a lot of me talking about my meditations. I used to be able to sit for 2.5 hours in a very quiet space. And I wondered for a while why I felt moved to stop doing that is because I did learn the lesson of quietude and the fact that there is serenity and calm inside me, but there's not much I could learn from that beyond my inner strength. And what's being talked about here in the Zen Satori is getting away from quietude and whilst in meditation, very much looking intensely at all the different thoughts and all the different objective spurs that come in that begin to bring images of the outside world. Part of the Zen Satori is becoming one with the objective and losing ourselves in our wholeness with everything, I think, sort of. Whereas other mystics were trying to burn that self out with asceticism and become nothing. The Buddha is a lot of things. It's not nothing. It's everything, which is very, very cool. I'm not quite there yet. Well, all right. That's about all I got for this week. I'm going to go grab Odin, and we're going to see what he has to say. He has been delightful, and I'm very proud of him. I hope you have a child that you're proud of. It's one of the best feelings in the world. I love you all. Thank you so much for tuning in to The Gingerbread Man. I very much appreciate your ears and your attention. You are a special, divine being who has an immense impact, and you can create beauty or you can hurt, but that's part of our humanity, and you have to respect and not regret any part of who you are. So thank you for waking up this morning, and thank you for being who you are. Thank you. Let's go find out.
Hello, people. This is Asko speaking with the Gingerbread Man.
Yeah.
So how was your day? Good? Okay, so guess what? I just got a watch. I didn't tell you guys it. It's a smartwatch.
Tell me about it. What does it do?
Nothing.
It doesn't do anything at all?
Yeah, it doesn't do anything.
At all?
At all.
It doesn't tell the time?
Yeah, it doesn't tell the time.
And what's it for?
It's just for a cool look. It's just a fake one.
It's a fake cool smartwatch, is what he says. But that's not true.
No, it actually is true. I actually made it a watch with paper and then cut it out. Then I covered it to look like a watch.
Oh. You have a lot of imagination, my child.
I did not. I did not do that. You did it.
All right, guys. Thank you.
Have a nice day.
Yeah, day? Have a great day. We'll see you next time. Bye.
Dot.